Welcome to 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that 1517 produces. And while you're over at 1517.org, make sure you go and click on the events page and register for that Here We Still Stand regional event in Northwest Arkansas. Registrations are rolling in, Chad. People are signing up. Seems like they are got that bug to get around some other people, maybe hear the gospel, which I guarantee you will hear, because the theme of the conference is, check it out, a gospel conference. My buddy, Scott Davis, who is a pastor and a magician, so just the two greatest things that you could possibly be, he is going to be doing the devotions, because Chad's doing some actual speaking. So, you know, a lot of times I know people love the early bird devotions, but Chad can't do devotions and give plenary talks. So Scott Davis is coming, and he's going to be doing the devotions. And I was talking with him, and he texted me and said, "Hey, I'm just thinking about this devotion for the conference. Is there anything you want me to cover, you know, theme wise?" I said, "Well, it's going to be a little bit difficult for you because the theme is the gospel." And he said, "Oh, okay. I think
it's gonna be a rough one."
Yeah, he's like, "I think I can come up with something then." So, you know, when we were theming out, I just felt like this year, after 2020, it's time for some good news. And I don't know of any better news, Chad, than the gospel.
Let's talk about Jesus at a conference. Yeah. That's a good idea.
Yeah, let's just talk about who he is, what he did, who he did it for. That's you.
Am I supposed to be talking about the gospel in the Old Testament?
Something like that, right? I'm sure.
Yeah,
like
yeah. That. I guess yeah. I probably should read a few books just to brush up on that.
Yeah, read a couple of your own books, get all brushed up. But yeah, guys, register for that. It's only $65 for a 2-day event. It's gonna be a good time. Cool area. It's the area that I choose to live in, so you know that it must be great. Because why would I make that decision if it wasn't? It's not as though I haven't had people trying to coax me to move to different areas of the country, and I don't do it because I like where I live. So you should come hang out with Chad and me and Eric and Loso and Jared C. Wilson and Scott Davis and Gretchen Ronovic. Andy Gullihorn's going to be doing a concert there. If you don't know who that is, you're really missing out. He is fantastic. There's a link in the show notes as well. You can click on that, get registered. No matter, you know, we got a great little airport here too. You can fly in here from anywhere. So even if you're not in the tri-state area, as it were, but you want to come anyway, come on and come hang out. All right, Chad, we left David stealing a spear from the side of, right, that was stuck in the ground next to Saul's head, and saying, "I'm going to take your water jug too." And everyone's asleep, and him and his guy have escaped with these things, and that's just where we left it. He's got some of Saul's belongings in his possession.
Yeah, we kind of left everybody hanging there, wondering what was gonna happen next. It's been quite the scene so far. I mean, it's like, in some ways, the account we covered a few episodes ago, where Saul was in the cave relieving himself. But this is different. As I pointed out last time, David is going on the initiative at this point. He sends out his own spies. He finds out where Saul's at. He waits until he has the cover of darkness. And he and one of his closest buddies, who's a nephew of his, they have snuck down into the camp. And so we'll see what happens at this point. I don't remember if I pointed this out last time, but when it says that, it doesn't just say they were asleep, but it says a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them, or a deep sleep, as the ESV translates it. Interestingly, and forgive me if I'm repeating myself from last time, this is the same Hebrew word that is used in Genesis chapter 2 and then in Genesis 15 to describe the deep sleep that God put Adam in and the deep sleep that Abraham fell into right before he had that vision. So God puts those two guys, and then he puts all the camp of Saul into this tardema, the Hebrew word for that deep or sound sleep. So as you read through these stories, sometimes it could seem as if this is just kind of one action described after another action, these series of actions in this narrative. And sometimes it's almost as if God isn't there, or if he is there, he's just being spoken of as objectively described, like, you know, God is with us, or God is going to reward me, or something like that. This is one of these few occasions in this narrative where we have a description of how God is actively helping out David in this particular situation by putting a deep sleep on the camp of Saul. So anyway, picking it up with verse 13, 1 Samuel 26, 13, it says that David crossed over to the other side and he stood on top of a hill with a great space between them. So he's put a little distance between himself and the camp before he starts to call out to the camp and wake everyone up and deliver this speech that he has prepared on the spot, as it were. So David called to the people, and it says specifically to Abner, the son of Ner, who of course is Saul's uncle and his top man in the military. So he begins by addressing Abner. He says, "Will you not answer, Abner?" And then Abner, I'm assuming just kind of waking up and not really knowing what's going on, says, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David then answers him, "Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel?" So he starts out kind of like, as it were, complimenting Abner, like, nobody's like you in Israel. You're a soldier like no other. But then he switches. As soon as he gives him a compliment, as it were, he goes on the attack. He says, "Why then have you not guarded your lord, the king? For one of the people came to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die because you did not guard your lord, your master, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was at his head." So this is David, I guess you could say, trash-talking Abner. He's pointing out to him that he might be a good soldier, but he failed miserably at his duty. In fact, he failed so miserably that, yeah, Saul is out here looking for me, but truth be told, if there's anybody who needs to be put to death, it's actually you, because you fell asleep when you should have been on duty taking care of the king.
Yeah, this is almost like he calls out, you know, who are you that calls the king? And David's response is like, "Well, you're a big, strong guy, aren't you? Look at you. You're just a man among men. Too bad you're going to have to be put to death for being so sleepy."
Yeah, he's really rubbing it in Abner's face. We're typical David. I mean, David is never lacking for words. He, as we've seen before, he can deliver a speech when he wants to. So at this point in this back and forth, Saul takes over. So Saul recognizes David's voice, as he did earlier in the case of the cave. And he says, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Again, that's the same kind of language we saw last time. He doesn't refer to David as the son of Jesse. And he not only refers to him by name, but he calls him my son. So repeat there from the two stories. And David affirms, "Yes, it is my voice, my Lord, the king." It's interesting always to note in these exchanges too, how David, even though David is the Lord's anointed, even though David knows good and well that he's going to be the next king, Saul's replacement, he never does not call Saul the king. So he acknowledges that he is in fact the Lord, the king, the anointed one of God. And that's of course the reason why he will not do anything to harm him. So even though David is king, is the Lord's chosen, he also is acknowledging that the Lord at an earlier point chose Saul. So he is not going to do him any harm.
It's interesting how Saul's language changes every time that his life has been in jeopardy. it's almost like he realizes that he easily could have just been dead, and all of a sudden the way that he speaks is, "David, my son, my dearest son-in-law, is that you?"
It's a quick transformation.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing how when you realize you could have been dead, that changes your perspective quite rapidly. Even though, as we've seen with Saul, he'll change his perspective, and then you flip the page in the Bible, and he's out there pursuing David again. Yep. So he waffles back and forth on his commitment to do David no harm. Then David continues after saying, "Yes, it's me." He said, "Why then is my Lord pursuing his servant? What have I done? What evil is in my hand?" So he's claiming innocence, just like he's done before. "Now, therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant. If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let him accept an offering. But if it is men, Cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today, that I should have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, go serve other gods. Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts for a partridge in the mountains. So this is pretty fascinating, actually. The assumption that David seems to be putting forward here is that by men turning Saul against him, that's kind of the way that David is framing this, they are forcing David away from the Holy Land, so that if he's away from the Holy Land, he's going to be forced to serve other gods.
Yeah, or even makes it seem like people have maybe told him, maybe you should go serve another god, because it doesn't seem like serving this god is going to happen for you, and you're overly devoted. We saw when David went to the Philistines and stuff. Now, obviously, David has a reputation with the Philistines, and they might not love him. But the Philistines are a different kind of people, and it would not be surprising if David came in and said, look, the king is after me, he's betrayed me, I'm converting. That the Philistines probably wouldn't mind having a David. They seem like fairly pragmatic, right? That they would be, you can come fight for us.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we'll see that in the next chapter, that is the route that David takes. Yeah, so... I mean, you got to always keep in mind when you're in any part of the Old Testament, that the view of Israel, at least from the perspective of all the peoples around them, would have been extremely narrow. Because if you went to live with the Philistines, if you went to live with the Amalekites or with the Egyptians or whoever, I mean, back then, all of the religions were pretty open. They were fine with you adding other deities to their pantheon. We saw that in the case of the exile of the ark in the early chapters of 1 Samuel, where the Philistines were just basically going to take the ark of Yahweh and they were going to put it in the temple of their god Dagon, not really in any sense in which they were rejecting it, but they were trying to add it, more or less. Hey, look, you know, we can add to the number of deities that we worship. We'll just tack on Yahweh right alongside of Dagon. And this was not unusual at all. This happened not only in this particular time period, but much later with the Greeks and the Romans. The Greeks would go in and they would, you know, they'd be fine with adding the gods of those that they conquered to the ones that they worship. They were pretty open about all this. Then you go to the Israelites and you find the exact opposite extreme. One God, and not only one God to be worshiped, but one God, period. So it wasn't just what's called monolatry. Monolatry is when you worship one God, that's the mono part, but you don't deny the existence of others. Now, this is monolatry and monotheism in Israel. So a belief in one God and worship of one God to the purposeful exclusion of all other deities.
Yeah, it's one thing to have a God that you worship. It's another thing to have a God that you worship while simultaneously saying that everyone around you, their gods aren't gods.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a little more insulting.
It's very insulting. And to add even more insult to that, we certainly find this in the New Testament. We've already seen it in Deuteronomy as well. Not only do the Israelites believe that these non-Israelite deities are not deities, but that they are the mask of demonic forces. So it's like, we're not only going to insult you, but we're gonna double down on that insult. We're gonna say not only is your God, we'll say Dagon, not only is Dagon not a real deity, actually he's nothing more than the mask of a dark demonic force. So that puts a very different spin on our understanding of idolatry in the Old Testament. And of course, when you get to the books of like 1 Corinthians, Paul says the same thing, right? Those who offer their sacrifices to the pagan gods offer them to demons. So, I mean, and it, when you kind of step back and think about it, it makes perfect sense. What better disguise for dark and sinister forces in the world than religion?
We'll see this when Elijah goes against, you know, the prophets of Baal and this kind of thing, where there is one group or one man, Elijah, who does not believe the Baal has any power whatsoever, right? Mm-hmm. This is not the same for the prophets of Baal. They're in a God showdown. They're not there to say that Elijah's God isn't real. They're just there. The competition is which God is more powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Elijah says, "Well, there's just not a competition because there's only one God showing up to the fight because your God is not a God." And we see what kind of insult this is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the Philistines are much like that in the sense that when they captured the Ark, they had fought with the Israelites. They knew what was up with the Ark. They absolutely believe that the God of Israel is a God. Mm-hmm. This is not up for debate for them at all. They're like, of course Yahweh is. They just reject the idea that he's the only God.
Right. Yeah. And another kind of twist, getting back to the specifics of this verse, is just how rooted the presence of the Lord is to the soil of Israel. So in verse 20, he says, this is David speaking, don't let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. So there is this definitely this sense in the Old Testament to where, of course, God is the God of heaven and earth, but he has specifically chosen to anchor his presence to the Holy Land. That's why it's called the Holy Land. All of the soil, as it were, outside of the land of Israel is not holy because that is not where God has chosen to be. Now, we could go to the Psalms, for instance, talk about God being present with people in the midst of their exiles, and that is certainly true. But what David seems to be accenting here is that, listen, the covenant land of Israel, that real estate, is what God has chosen to be the inheritance of his people. And now if you're driving me away from that, you're really driving me away from the presence of the Lord himself. And that's why exile is always considered to be not just kind of a vacation from the Holy Land. We're going to go travel and experience the world. Exile is death, basically. I mean, it can be followed by resurrection, but exile is in itself a kind of death. And so you're always wanting to return to the land.
Yeah, this is sort of David acknowledging what a lot of Christians need to acknowledge, which is that God is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
He is not everywhere in the same way.
Yes.
David knows this. David knows that God is everywhere. I mean, he says, like, no matter where I go, you are. He does not believe that God is everywhere in the same way, doing the same thing for the same reason, right? Mm-hmm. So Christians today would say something like, well, you know, don't need the church to be a Christian. I mean, God is everywhere. You can pray in your house or in your yard or whatever. And that's true, right? Mm-hmm. Certainly God is in those places. But he is not in those places. He is not promised to be in those places doing a particular thing. And this is the difference. I think it's Ambrose who says, I think I've said this before, that God is everywhere, like water is everywhere. So it's in the very air that we breathe. There's water everywhere. But if I need a drink, I go to a well.
Mm-hmm.
And so yeah. Water is not everywhere in the same way.
Yeah, I do think that's probably, if not the most, at least one of the top three misconceptions mm-hmm. that I encounter quite a bit in the church today. There is this idea that, well, let me rephrase it. Is the omnipresence of God reassuring? Yeah. I mean, it's good to know that wherever I am, like Psalm 139 says, yeah, if I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there.
If you get imprisoned, you know that you are not alone. This is good to
right.
know.
Yeah, it's always good to know that wherever we are, there God is with us. However, you have to add to that the fact that when you want to directly receive the gifts of God in Christ, then he has given those in very specific places, very specific sorts of things. And that's why we go to his table. That's why we go to his word. That's why we go to baptism, to these very specific kinds of places where God has promised not just to kind of be in an omnipresent sort of way, but in a very specific gift-giving sort of way.
Yeah, when Jesus says, where two or more are gathered, this does push back against the wherever you go, there I am, which is true. But what he is saying that even within the fellowship of two believers, even just two, the assembly of two saints, that he is in the midst of them in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And David, we know, I think we know this. Like, I mean, it is not the same for me to, if I'm just sitting around my house by myself reading my Bible, that's great. And certainly the Spirit is there, and that's wonderful. It is not the same as if you and I, Chad, or you and I and a couple other people get together and start talking about the Scriptures. This is different.
Mm-hmm. It's very different. Yeah. You see that all over the Old Testament with the admonition to talk about the Scriptures when you're with others. And of course you see it just basically built into the whole communal life of Israel, as well as the church.
And that's why we do this podcast with two people. We didn't start it with one guy, because we wanted to make sure the Lord was present with us.
Right. Yeah.
It was just me or just Chad, we have no promise that the Lord is among us. But because it's a two man operation, we know that it's actually a three person operation. It's
there you go.
Me, Chad, and God.
That's right. Okay. I think that's all we have on that speech. I'll add this kind of as a little Hebrew tidbit. When verse 14, when Abner says, "Who are you who calls to the king?" So the verb there is kara. And then you jump down to the very end of this back and forth. And David says that he is being hunted as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. Kind of a strange metaphor to use, but the word for partridge is a pun off of call. So to call is kara, and a partridge is a kore. So it seems as if David is making a pun on Abner's response to him.
It also seems like this is a double thing going on here. One, when he says like a flea, a partridge. Yes, he's saying these are insignificant things, right? Like, so
yes.
Why would you be hunting these things? But also, difficult to find things. I mean, so,
right.
So like, I mean, you could tell someone, you're like, hey, why are you searching for a flea amongst the land? One, that's ridiculous because a flea is insignificant. Two, you will never find him, right?
Right. Yeah.
I think David may be doing both of these things. Like, you're not going to find me. You're not going to get me. Also, why are you so obsessed with getting? What am I? Who am I?
Yeah. Why are you wasting your time? Yeah, he did improve the metaphor. Last time he called himself a dead dog. So this time he calls himself a partridge. So it's a little bit better way of referring to yourself.
Maybe he's realized that dead dogs can't escape. So he's like, you know what? I do a lot of escaping. So I'm like
a bird. Better change my metaphor. Okay, so David is finished with his speech. What's Saul going to say? Saul starts out with a confession. The very first words out of his mouth are, "I have sinned." Which is very much like a couple of other confessions. It's very much, first of all, like Pharaoh says. Later on in the plagues, in Exodus chapter 9, verse 27, Pharaoh is driven to the point where he himself confesses that he has sinned. And it's not only like that, but when you get to 2 Samuel chapter 12, this is after the prophet confronts David with his own sin of concerning Bathsheba and Uriah. Then David also says, "I have sinned." It's a pretty common confession that you have in the scriptures. "Return, my son David," he says, "for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error." That's quite a confession on
yeah.
Saul's part.
Yeah, especially if he's saying this in front of all his men, which you assume he is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's in the middle of the camp.
He's
shouting it,
I assume.
Right, he's surrounded by all these men who have followed him to search for this flea in the mountains. Yeah, so for him to humble himself, almost humiliate himself in the presence of his men by this kind of confession, you can imagine how they're just kind of glancing back and forth to each other, like, "Who are we following?
Yeah,
that would do something like this." Then David is not quite finished because he needs to point out something. He says, "Look, the spear of the king. Now let one of the young men come over and take it." So he points out that he could have killed Saul, but he chose not to. And then he says, "The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and for his faithfulness. For the Lord has delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Now look, as your life was great in my eyes, Other translations will say precious or highly valued, but it's literally, as your life was great in my eyes, so may my life be great in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all distress. So basically, David is saying that I've acted with righteousness, I've acted with faithfulness, which is true. With regard to Saul, he certainly has on multiple occasions. And he's testifying that in the end, the Lord will not only deliver him from all of these dangers that he faces, but also will give him that which he's already promised him.
Yeah, I kind of like this too, that David says, just as I have viewed your life as precious, great, valuable, which, by the way, David has little reason to view Saul's life that way. What is it in and of Saul that would cause David to say, this life is precious, this life is great? Well, nothing. Like, Saul's been horrible to David. He's a madman. He's sinned against David terribly. And David says, just as your life has looked like that in my eyes, I hope that my life looks like that in the Lord's eyes.
Yeah, he doesn't say in your eye, in Saul's eyes, right?
No, in the Lord's eyes, which this is nice, because what you would like is that God would look at, he's hoping that God looks at him the way that he looks at Saul. And the way that he looks at Saul is like this horrific sinner, horrible person who he will not destroy, though. And he said, that'd be nice if God looked at me that way, too. Let's hope that this is the case. It'd be nice if God looked at all of us the way that David looked at Saul, knowing that what a wretched person this is, but restraining himself from destroying you. This is a good thing to ask God to do.
That's some gospel in the Old Testament right there.
There it is.
Yeah. And to add to that, specifically, because why does David look at him this way? Because he's the Lord's anointed.
Well, he looks at him this way because of what God has said about him, declared about him, right? This is a little gospel nugget here where David says, hey, it's not that I'm going to ask you to look at me that way. I hope that God looks at me that way, because David knows he's a sinner too, right? Mm-hmm. And so if God could look at me the way that I just looked at you, I'll be okay.
Yeah. That's some of that grace just pouring out of unexpected places like that. Okay, verse 25, that's the last verse in the chapter. And this is not only the last word in the last verse in the chapter, this is the last thing that Saul will ever say to David. So these are his concluding words. And it's quite a way in which to end their strange relationship that they've had, all the way from when he was Saul's musician to when he fought Goliath, and now leading through all these twists and turns up to this point. This is the last words that Saul will say to David.
Don't you feel like these words are just more of, is Saul among the prophets? This almost sounds like a prophetic statement. Like Saul says something that actually will come to pass. And Saul is an unlikely mouthpiece. I don't know if Saul has ever shaken whatever prophetic thing he had going on.
Yeah, I fully agree. This is, I mean, it's pretty undeniable that it is prophetic, because this is exactly what will come to pass. So he begins with a word of blessing. So Saul says to David, blessed be you, Baruch, blessed be you, my son, David. So he repeats not only his name, which of course for a long time he wouldn't do. He'd just call him Jesse's son. And he calls him once more his son. Blessed be you, my son, David. Now, here's the English translation. This is ESV. You will do many things and will succeed in them. That's ESV. Let me read you the New American Standard. You will both accomplish much and surely prevail. Now, what's going on in the Hebrew here is something that we encounter on a fairly regular basis. So when Hebrew really wants to emphasize something, what it will do is it will repeat the verb in a little bit different grammatical form each time. It's what's called the infinitive absolute. So it'll take the verb and basically double the verb. So here, what we would, to translate it somewhat literally, be something like, you will doingly do, and you will succeedingly succeed, something along those lines. So you won't just do things and be successful. You will, as it says, you will do great things or many things, and you won't just succeed, but you won't just be able to do them, but you will do them extremely successfully. Now, I just realized this. I love it when I learn something completely new, and I did this morning getting ready for this. So I knew these were the last words that Saul speaks to David. So I went back and went through chapter 16 and 17, read through that whole narrative again, and I found the very first recorded words that Saul spoke to David to compare these two. Well, it turns out that there's a parallel between these two. So let me read you this is 1 Samuel 17:33. This is the first recorded words that Saul says to David, and this is after David volunteers to fight Goliath. Saul says to him, "You are not able to go against this Philistine." Now, the verb that he uses there is the exact same verb that he uses here in chapter 26, verse 25, when he says that you will do many things and will succeed in them. See, yakal is the verb, and this is Saul basically beginning his relationship with David saying, you can't do that. You're not going to be successful. And then now you get to the very end. He not only says you're going to be successful, but you are actually going to do remarkably well in what you set out to do. And that's his closing words. Chapter ends with David went on his way and Saul returned to his place.
Yeah, so Saul's first words to David are, you can't win. His last words to David is, you're going to do a lot of winning.
Yes, that's precisely right. Yeah, but I love the way that those bookends start out with this skepticism. There's no way you're going to be able to fight against this giant and win. Well, David does that almost without breaking a sweat. And then after all this, finally Saul is, it's as if he understands David. He's like, yeah, you're not really able. You're going to do extremely, extremely well. And that's the last time that Saul and David will have any conversation. Okay, so we have a few minutes left. Let's jump into the next chapter, which is pretty short, actually. It's only 12 verses, one of the shorter chapters in 1 Samuel. But it's a really weird chapter. It's really weird only because this is a highly, highly risky move on the part of David. What he's going to do is he is basically going to say, you know what? I can't get anything done in the borders of the land of Israel. In fact, it's extremely dangerous for me because even though Saul just said this to me, we all know that Saul goes back on his word. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go and live with the Philistines.
Yeah, there it is.
Which, I mean, we could think of a lot of modern examples where a parallel would be established. I mean, think of a future leader of the modern state of Israel decides that, you know, the best thing for him to do would be to go and live in one of the Arab nations that are the enemies of Israel and then come back later. It's an odd move on David's part, highly risky, but he does it, and no surprise, it works for David. Here's what he says to himself, literally in his heart. This is the first recorded inner monologue that David has. So he's thinking in his heart, in his head. He says, "Now I will perish one day by the hand of Saul. There's nothing better for me to do than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Saul then will despair of searching for me anymore in all the territory of Israel, and I will escape from his hand." So he's just complained about men driving him away from the land of Yahweh, and here he voluntarily decides he's going to exile himself instead of being driven away quite literally by the forces of Saul. He's going to remove himself from the danger.
Now, if you're going to do this, Chad, there is one thing that you definitely have to do, and that's you have to make it appear that you're defecting, that you are mm-hmm. down for fighting against the enemies of the Philistines. Of course, David will do that. He will say that this is what he is down for doing.
What he's doing. Yeah. I mean, he's got of course, a very sizable group of soldiers. He's got the 600 soldiers, but I'm assuming that with these soldiers, well, not only assuming, we know from later chapters, a lot of these guys have their families with them. So we're not just talking about 600 men. We're talking about in the thousands when you count up wives, potentially multiple wives, and kids. So David gets up. He crosses over his 600 soldiers, and he goes to our old friend Achish, the son of Maok, the king of Gath. So this is the same guy when David went, when David had to flee there at one point, and then he had to pretend he was a madman, scratching the walls, saliva on his beard in order to escape. This is the same guy. And this, by the way, is the same hometown of Goliath, which just makes him stranger.
Do you have to assume that David, while I'm sure the Philistines hate David, David is as much of a sort of, he's as much of a celebrity as someone can be at that point, I would think.
I would think so too.
So, they might hate him, but he's got to be Israel famous, but he's got to be Philistine famous.
Oh sure, yeah. Probably from the moment he killed Goliath, then David was a household name in all the cities of the Philistines. And he's not only well known, but he's probably respected.
That's kind of what I mean. Like, I'm sure they don't like him, but there probably is this. There's a respect there, and a respect that's enough that if you come in and say, look, my home country's turned its back on me, how about I join up with you? When you have like the level of fame that I assume he does, this is like an intriguing thing too. I mean, lost a lot of battles to this guy. It's be maybe like, all right, like, well, why don't you let's see if we can work something out, right?
Yeah, and the Philistine leader, if he's a wise leader, he's gonna realize that the politically wise move here would be to say, well, we'll take you. I mean, you fought against us, but we know that you're a great warrior. So if you're willing to fight on our side, yeah.
Yeah, 600 guys.
Come on over. You got 600 guys with you. We know what you can do. So sure, we'd rather you be fighting with us than against us. So that's what happens. David moves in with all his men with Achish. Yeah, they have their household, and he has his at least two wives so far. Right now, they're listed there, Ahinoam and Abigail, that we met a couple of chapters ago. And then it works. Verse 4 says that Saul finds out, and so he no longer searched for David. So what David wanted to happen did happen. He was finally not forced to basically live the life of a man on the run out in the wilderness. So he's living there in the city of Gath, but he doesn't really want to stay there for more than one reason. He wants a little freedom. He wants some independence. So he says to the king one day that if I found favor in your eyes, then give me my own place. Let me have one of your cities out in the country so that I can live there.
Yeah, this is a bold move. He's not just asking for, hey, can I get a house? Like, he's giving him like a town, right?
Yeah.
He's giving him a town. I assume David's going to take all his men and me and my men are going to live in this town. Still, it's a bold move. I mean, just to say... I mean, he couches it in this, I mean, why should your servant dwell in royalty? You know, like, I shouldn't be living in the royal city with you. Just, you know, give me a town outside and I'll just live out there. And he does.
Yeah. He's like, sure. In fact, I got just the place for you. It's a place called Ziklag. And you can basically have it. And we have a little editorial note here that says Ziklag has thus belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. So it didn't before, but. And from that point on, it did. So David takes all his men. They move there. And David is going to be in the country of the Philistines, living in Ziklag for 16 months, a year and 4 months, which is how verse 7 ends. Now, we'll find out in the next episode that David is not just kind of kicking back and drinking wine under his fig tree and enjoying the companionship of his two wives and making more children. He's actually got a plan. He's got a master plan in mind that involves raiding parties and increasing his wealth and making sure that dead men tell no tales.
Yeah.
So making sure that he leaves everybody dead.
Yeah, this
might inform on him.
As we talked earlier, like going into the land of the Philistines and saying, hey, I've been driven out. Maybe I could live here, be with you guys, join up. That's kind of risky. But as we talked about it before, it seems like that's something you could do. David's fame and notoriety might afford him the opportunity to do that. The super risky thing is the plan, which you need your own spot, and you need to be kind of like have your guys around you. And what he's going to do in this 16 months is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah. One mistake, one person gets away, and it's all over.
Yep.
for David.
Yep.
So a highly, highly risky move, yeah. So which we'll get to next time.
Yeah. So we'll next week, we will find out what the master plan of David is amongst the Philistines and how it works out. Chad, I'll see you next week.
All right. See you then.